Here's how this works. On this podcast, we try to keep things going in a sort of chronological order. We started at the beginning, and, you know, we mean the very beginning, trying to explain the origins of Mormon cosmology to the unwashed masses. We're hearing that some of you are starting to wash, though, and, you know, good job for you. We appreciate that.
I hope it's in cinnamon whiskey.
It should be, if you're being accurate. And, you know, then we worked our way up to Joseph Smith and his family, the beginnings of the church, Kirtland, yada, yada, yada. Missouri, nice to meet you. And, you know, now we're here in Nauvoo. Some say we glossed over the stories of early Mormonism way too quickly, and those people are 100% correct. We are both in a hurry to talk about lesser-known periods in church history. The Frontier Period, the Manifesto Years, the Mormon Underground, the Progressive Era. Yes, ma'am.
But I say, as lady of the podcast, that I think we should be able to go back in time whenever we feel like it. We don't ever skip ahead too much, right? Because we're following the rules. And, you know, if you're not following the rules and listening to the podcast in order, I'm doing the Year of Polygamy thing. Start at episode one and go in order, because we talk about things in these podcasts that you need to know. But we don't ever skip too far ahead, because we want you to have a good foundation of what we're talking about. And we're trying to structure the story so that our audience can sort of have a good working knowledge. When Brian makes a really nerdy joke, you'll understand the joke. You might not laugh. You'll probably not laugh at it.
Excuse me, you'll laugh until you cry.
We want you to have good foundation so you can sort of get the nuances of why we're choosing what we're choosing to add. It's kind of fun to get a bigger picture of things. And you have to have a foundational understanding of some of these things. And that's why we don't skip ahead. But I feel like there's nothing in the rule book about skipping back to things. Right, Brian?
Right. And yeah, I'm in a hurry to talk about the golden age of John Y. Barlow and his trust issues with his brothers. There's a joke in there somewhere. But I do think we can take the episodes in the past a little. So let's take some stock right now. We're in Nauvoo, squarely in the 1839 to 46 period. It's a short time in Mormon history, but where a lot happens. So we're still going to be in Nauvoo for a while yet. We got to talk about some of the important things there. So hold to Nauvoo.
We just thought we'd shake it up a bit since it's Halloween coming up and fall time's coming right around the mountain. I want to talk about 1820s in America because it's perfect Puritan spooky time. Is that okay with you, Brian?
I'll be happier 100 years later, but whatever. This better be good, lady of the podcast.
It's good. Let's put it this way. It's as good as Joseph Smith's favorite beer recipe.
I'd never tell a man to ask my daddy for my hand. I've got a thousand tales about the temper.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan,
bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
At the top of the hour, Lindsay brings up Joseph Smith and beer in the same sentence. She did this on purpose because she's a troublemaker. She's that kind that at Thanksgiving, once you've gotten everybody calmed down again, she mumbles, but her emails, sets off Aunt Gladys again.
Listen, I've never said anything about but her emails to Aunt Gladys. And as listeners on our podcast reviews have noted, we should not make this podcast political. So shape up, Brian.
I said nothing about Trump and you know it.
Every good Mormon knows that Joseph Smith didn't drink beer. As Blanche Devereaux from The Golden Girls famously said, I love this quote, the wildest thing that ever passed through him was Ovaltine. Modern LDS and other types of Mormons have long held to the word of wisdom or a health code, which according to us means you abstain from alcohol, all alcohol, even the appearance of alcohol.
And if you've listened to the earlier podcast episodes, you already know this because we did an entire episode on the word of wisdom.
Yes, and I did do an epically long one on Year of Polygamy as well. Epically. But basically, yes, modern Mormons really find it shocking when they hear that early Mormons actually kind of like their alcohol. And if you listen to our Hosea Stout episode, you'll know that they really like their alcohol. The way that the doctrine was understood and now is understood has changed a lot over time. I know that's shocking for some people. So while Joseph Smith and beer isn't a big deal to most people everywhere else, to a lot of modern Latter-day Saints, it's still quite the scandal.
Well then, let's get ready to scandalmonger. Let's walk our story back to 1820s America.
It's 1820s America with lots going on. The War of 1812 concludes and they call it the Era of Good Feelings. I like that, the Era of Good Feelings. I wish we could get a little bit of those good feelings back in this era.
Say, this era is going to have a slightly different name. Era of Good Vaccines, maybe?
The Era of Good Facebook Arguments? I don't know. Good? Relative? We don't even know what's true anymore. So in 1812, there's this terrible war, land war, happening in America right after the Revolutionary War. They thought they were done with wars with the British, but they were not. And when it ends, gone, at least for a little reprieve, were these bitter feelings of division left over from the war and the devastation from the war that impacted everywhere. And the war is kind of a strange war. It's basically fought over maritime rights. And the British, they stop all trade coming over from the ocean. And this radically reshifts the entire New England economy. The war cuts off trade that had supported all these New England port towns. There was a lot of folks, at that time you were either a farmer or a shipbuilder, really. And that made everyone either try their hand at farming or brew. So as historian William Davis points out, Joseph Smith Jr. was born and raised through wartime and the aftermath of several big wars on American soil. And that really has to affect a kid. I really like that Bill Davis points this out because it's an aspect of his identity that really doesn't ever get mentioned. And certainly the shifting economy affected the Smith family. These changes, along with this Anglo expansion into the hills and borders of the new American frontier, was an interesting recipe to start a life together. And this is precisely the kind of climate that Joseph Smith Jr.'s parents, Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack, meet and get married in. A thorough study of their lives sort of gives us an incredible insight to the beginnings of Mormonism and Mormonism's founder, Joseph Smith Jr. But we don't have time for a really thorough study, so this will have to do. A solid hour of our favorite facts about Joseph Smith's parents.
Archaeological evidence suggests that in the very early days of Lucy and Joseph Sr.'s marriage, they tried their hand at a little farming, the early colonial American stereotype card. Those were just the rules. The area was known for making hops, obviously, so you could make beer with them. Most likely they farmed hops or apples.
And here's a fun fact. The kind of apples that they grew in that area, other than the Bethel apples, was a type of apple called the Blushing Maiden. And I feel like that's like some weird foreshadowing, Smith's growing Blushing Maidens.
See, with the apples, there was this long-standing discussion about how many bushels of apples Joseph Smith could pick in a day. Most observers argued it was 33, but some even put the number higher.
Wait a minute, I see what you did there.
I will say that I had a second half to that joke that I redacted. You're welcome.
Blushing Maiden apple sauce.
Yeah, tender apples, the... Something.
Brian's got plenty of applesauce today. I'll tell you what.
All sorts of apple jokes here. All right. How about this for a fun fact? Lucy Mack Smith, Prof. Joseph's mother, grew up hanging around the tavern. Her sister and close friend, Lydia Mack Bell, had inherited a tavern in Gilsum, New Hampshire. That's a good inheritance. You get my jewelry and a tavern.
And remember, this is still like turn of the century, 1700s. This is like some Ichabod Crane stuff. So a tavern.
Taverns are important.
They're like wearing three-pointed hats and carrying their stein of beer.
And
singing.
Clearly a hand-painted wooden sign out in front. I mean, that's just guaranteed. So Lucy's brother Stephen owned a giant tavern in Tunbridge where Lucy farmed with her husband Joseph Sr. in the early years of their marriage. It's even possible she was working there at her brother's tavern when she met Joseph.
Even after Lucy got married and left the farm in Vermont, she still had a taste for the hops. She started a cake and beer shop in Palmyra, and it basically is an early rendition of a food truck. So yes, it should have been a pie and beer truck, but sometimes people don't shoot their shot. It was kind of a portable tavern stand that sold sour pickled eggs. We are definitely kindred spirits here, pickled stuff, different kinds of sweetbreads and other tavern type foods. And she was apparently really good at this. She liked doing this. She knew how to sell beer, and she did this in New York. And then again, when they moved to Missouri.
And this was the time she also did the oilcloth paintings. So it's like Lucy was food truck and Etsy shop. So
I like it.
You know, she'd fit right in right now.
I know. I would.
Modern times.
I think I would like Lucy Mack.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay. So yes, the early Smith couple did a lot of brewing. It's possible that Joseph and Lucy raised hops on their farm in Tunbridge, like we said. Here's what historians Mark Staker and Donald Enders had to say about this based on archaeological digs that were done at the farm. Quote, Joseph, i.e. Joseph Sr., also had all the necessary requirements to produce his own beer if he chose. He had a cool, productive spring and access to plenty of barrels. Remember, he's a cooper from a lot of the time.
Coopers, just so you know, for those who don't know, coopers are barrel makers.
Yeah, so if you got some coopers in your neighborhood, just constantly ask them, hey, where's your barrels?
If you named your son Cooper, you named him after people that make beer.
Take that, Mormons.
Every sweet mom in Stansbury Park is like, wait, what?
My sweet little Cooper. Back to business. Hannah Glass's cookbook, used widely when the Smiths lived in Vermont, instructed brewers to use hogsheads and barrels at several stages of the beer brewing process. A cooper could readily make his own brewing equipment as well as the kegs needed to ship the final product. Glass's recipes used hops, sugar, and water as the main ingredients for her small beers. Other cookbooks outlined recipes for root beer that use ginger as their base but include yeast made from hops. This beer was a popular fare along with gingerbread at local militia gatherings in the spring and religious camp meetings throughout the year. It was the beer Lucy made and sold at her tavern stand in Palmyra. Her beer in Palmyra, quote, commanded brisk sales as evidence of her skill in production.
I want to eat a gingerbread made from Lucy Mack Smith. Like, is there anything more early American? Her little tavern stand with her gingerbread for the militia meetings.
She's checking all the ticks on that stereotype card.
According to Staker and Enders, after Joseph and Lucy abandoned the farming life in Tunbridge, they lived on the old turnpike that served travelers from Burlington to Hanover in Vermont. There was a distillery right up the street and 7 businesses in town that sold alcohol. So the Smith shop that they had there was likely involved in selling alcohol as well. And again, this is a big deal that Joseph Smith's parents sold alcohol because modern Latter-day Saints are very much opposed to drinking alcohol. And if you're in Utah under the Zion Curtain, we are very much against selling it too. But the prophet's mother knew how to brew beer quite well and sell it. Alcohol Commission. Remember that.
And all of this is prior to the temperance movement gaining steam. So not only were they making beer, they would serve rum punch at parties, they drink beer and harder stuff freely and often. It's just a big part of their culture. Remember, we've mentioned this multiple times, water at this point equals gross. Virtually anything else was preferable. Even
root beer made from ginger? I don't know. It's probably good.
Virtually anything else, maybe even V8 was preferable.
What were they eating tomatoes then? Had, you know, Thomas, what's his face?
No, we gotta wait for Mr. John C. Bennett to make him not poisonous.
That's right. Bennett was responsible.
One positive contribution to society.
I just want to note one important thing about this drinking culture that we're talking about for a minute, because I think it actually has a bigger impact on early Mormonism than we realize. As we noted, Lucy and Joseph Sr. are around alcohol all the time. It's part of the culture. It's after a war. The economy is struggling. It's shifting. It's reshaping. And we know that Joseph Sr. always struggled to support his family. We have the failed ginseng incident where he invests and it doesn't work out. And after that, they said, people that knew him said that he kind of resorted to magical thinking. He started treasure digging, and Joseph Sr. never really recovered. Most historians agree that he was an alcoholic. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that. Richard Bushman notes, quote, "The vicissitudes of life seemed to weigh heavily on Joseph Sr. In a patriarchal blessing given to Hiram, December 9th, 1834, Joseph Sr. commended Hiram for the respect he paid his father despite difficulties, quote, "Though he has been out of the way through wine, thou hast never forsaken nor laughed him to scorn." end quote. Since there is no evidence of intemperance after the organization of the church, Joseph Sr. likely referred to the time before 1826 when Hiram married and left home. And there's more that you can read about Joseph Sr.'s alcoholism. Sensen has a great article, The Smiths and Their Dreams and Visions by C. Jess Grosbeck. And they say, quote, years later, in an 1884 interview, Lorenzo Saunders referred to Joseph Sr.'s drinking, saying, quote, the old man, referring to Joseph Smith Sr., would always tell yarns. He would go to a turkey shoot, get tight, and then put spells on people's guns and tell them they would not be able to shoot. In the same decade, in an interview in the Saints Herald, William Kelly noted that Joseph Sr. and Joseph Smith Jr. sometimes drank together, most likely cider. And there are stories, more stories of Joseph Sr. drinking, making a fool of himself in front of the family, getting drunk, going missing. There are several accounts, and Brian just found one that we're going to refer to when we get into the fundamentalist period with the Woolies. Joseph Sr. wanders off to Samuel Woolley's house, doesn't tell his family where he's gone, and they're frantic. They don't know where he is. He struggled with alcoholism his whole life and couldn't quite get it together. And that had an impact on his son. Even though we're not talking a lot about Junior today, there is some interesting stories about Joseph Smith Jr. getting drunk. John Hammond talks about this in Volume 2, The Creation of Mormonism, Joseph Smith Jr. in the 1820s, The Quest for New Jerusalem, a Mormon generational saga. And here's what he has to say on it. Hammond says, quote, it is generally agreed among Mormon historians, apologists, as well as critics, that Joseph Sr. was virtually an alcoholic. But Dan Vogel points to incidents which took place during this period, which highlight Joseph Jr.'s drinking and violent tendencies. So now remember, we're talking about Joseph Jr. for a second. Joseph worked on his father's farm and hired out as a laborer on the farms during the ensuing year. While he was working for William Stafford, he got into another drunken fight. Barton Stafford, son of William, remembered that on one occasion while working in his father's field, Joseph, quote, got quite drunk on a composition of cider, molasses, and water. In fact, Stafford said he was so intoxicated he could barely stand and found it necessary to hold on to a nearby fence. After a while, he fell to scuffling with one of the workmen, who tore his shirt nearly off from him. Emma, who was in the house visiting, came out and appeared very much grieved at his conduct, and to protect his back from the rays of the sun and conceal his nakedness, threw her shawl over his shoulders, and in that plight escorted the prophet home. End quote. Gordon T. Smith, Lemuel Durfee's adoptive son, related a story about how Joseph's drinking while the latter was working for the senior Durfee. Joseph's presence at the Durfee farm on at least two unspecified occasions in August 1827 is confirmed in the employer's account book. When Durfee's wife discovered that Joseph had been sneaking drinks from the whiskey bottle in her pantry each morning before work, she switched the bottle for one containing pepper sauce, which caused Joseph considerable discomfort. So alcohol was definitely part of early Smith culture. It seems that Joseph Smith Sr. never quite could kick it. He probably suffered from depression. He probably suffered from a dependency on alcohol that he couldn't kick. And, you know, back in the 1820s, people saw it as a moral failing, not as a chemical dependency. That it's the era of good feelings with all this alcohol. I bet they were good feelings.
There's a reason for it.
Maybe all this drinking corresponds with all the mystic shiz that was going down around town, because this is the time where everyone at that time, and I mean everyone, was having visions, ecstatic experiences, seeing ghosts and spooks. One of my favorite books on Joseph Smith and Lucy Mack, hell, the entire Smith family in general, is turning out to be this one called Joseph and Lucy Smith's Tunbridge Farm, an Archaeology and Landscape History by Mark L. Staker and Donald L. Enders. And if the book sounds boring, it kind of is. If you're dead inside. Okay, I need to be honest and tell you that my rubric for what is interesting has long surpassed how normal, fun people consider to spend their time. But I was like really riveted reading this book because the scholars literally dig through the dirt on the early Smith farm.
The book is great. We're pulling heavily from it today. One of the fun chapters discusses Lucy Mack Smith's early visions. Let's dive into that for a minute. One thing New Englanders loved at least as much as the devil's juice was the Bible. Remember, the First and Second Great Awakening sweep through America during Lucy Mack's lifetime. This idea that religion was less formal and the divine belonged to every person, rich or poor, really took root.
Like root beer. Ginger root beer. Basically, you could have a vision and talk to God. It didn't matter if you were a sinner or saint, a preacher or parishioner, king or a peasant, God could speak to and through you. When Lucy was a girl, her older sister, Lovisa, how would you say that?
It's always been Lovisa in my head. I have my great grandmother's, maybe even one more great, her sister was named that.
Oh,
Lovisa, yeah.
Lovisa. Any Lovisas out there, let us know what you think. When Lucy was a girl, her older sister, Lovisa, became very sick. And when she was near death, Lovisa started having visions and spoke about being carried away to the world of the spirits. She talked about seeing the Savior through a veil, which is really interesting for Mormons later on when we talk about the temple. Apparently, during this vision, Jesus told her to return to her people and warn them to prepare for death. And suddenly, miraculously, she was healed.
And we know this story wasn't fully divine because there's no mention of Fred, the angel with the flaming sword. So
he never made an appearance. What the heck?
Yeah. And you know how all these near-death survivors are. Once they see Jesus, they will not shut up about it. Lucy's sister? No different. Lovisa spent the next 3 years doing what her vision had instructed. And Lucy was into it. She loved hearing her sister talk about the world beyond.
Lucy had another visionary sister named Levina. And I'm going to say, I think it's Levina. Their mom didn't make it easy. Can you imagine calling all those Lucy, Lovisa, Levina?
As a parent, it's hard enough not to get them mixed up. Don't give them similar names.
Levina got caught with the consumption and began having visions as well. And as she neared death, and unlike their elder sister, Lovisa, Levina would actually die at this time. She draws everyone to her bedside and asks them to have, quote, a change of heart. Lucy, who held her sister's hand as she passed, was only 13 at the time, but this greatly impacted her. The death of her sister, this idea of asking for a change of heart, and it becomes a lasting theme for Lucy.
And yeah, I mean, kids kind of had to face adult themes more frequently in teenage years, but that's some pretty heavy stuff for a 13-year-old to go through. Now, meanwhile, Joseph Smith Sr. grew up in a family of Universalists, and the Universalists depended more on rationalism and less on kind of this mystic mountain Christianity that Lucy grows up with. But because the culture at the time was teeming with all these religious upstarts everywhere, the couple would have been introduced to many, many different religious Christian movements. Shouting Methodists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, traveling preachers and stumpers, mountain preachers, more. I mean, that's what you did instead of hanging out on TikTok. So Staker and Enders write, quote, Methodist meetings were often camp meetings held in the woods outside of the primary villages. Beginning in 1800, their camp meetings found success throughout Orange County, particularly in Barnard, Bethel, and moving northwest along the main turnpike. The Methodists preach a Christianity sharply different from Universalism. They emphasize the gifts of the Spirit, getting answers to prayer, and receiving spiritual manifestations. During the meetings north of Tunbridge, quote, several found Jesus and others who had already believed were overwhelmed with his power. When the power fell on them, they swooned, fell to the ground, and cried out for mercy, or found themselves unable to speak with bound tongues. And that phrase, the power, is so interesting because if you remember when we talked about Emma, there was that one really cryptic phrase where it said, sometimes she was overcome with the power. So it's this kind of experience that they were talking about.
That's so interesting. This whole idea of speaking in tongues and having these experiences. Because listen, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I know religion has its problems no matter where you go. But what I wouldn't give to have old Sister Jensen go up on the stand swooning and speaking in tongues just once. Sacrament meeting would have been a whole lot more interesting. Although I do know people who have heard people speaking in tongues and they said it was a strange and frightening experience.
But see, it only works if Sister Christensen then gets up and interprets the message about the inhabitants of Kolob or, you know, whatever. So
it's exactly what we're talking about. If you have had one of those experiences, I want to hear you just send me a message. I'll try to make sure that I read it. I want to hear about times that you heard a member in your LDS congregation speaking in tongues at the pulpit.
Because you know there's strains of this that are still there. There has to be.
I hope so. Church can be a little bit dry and boring when you're LDS.
Yeah. So these movements, which are likely coupled with plenty of ale and alcohol and a great appreciation for not being any more land wars with the British, they take off. I mean, they take off. Really take off. Religious movements in the area became extremely popular. People literally could not keep themselves seated. Followers in these movements describe their inability to hold still during meetings, they're unable to keep their tongues quiet, and they're constantly yelling out their praise to God. Maybe we just need to get him all a bag of Cheerios and a quiet book so they can be more reverent.
I think Sister Jensen would appreciate that. I'm just telling you this. It sounds like an insane time to be an atheist because people are beginning to convert en masse. Sometimes 100 at a time will join, you know, some preacher that comes through town that's really interesting. Village by village, the most charismatic preachers drew together the largest congregations. And the key word to religious enthusiasm at the time was enthusiasm. If you weren't excited about Jesus, were you even a believer? Check out this camp meeting from the nearby Bethel Presbyterians. Who knew the Presbyterians were so crazy? This one was fun because the Presbys invited the Methodists along for the ride. Staker and Ender says, quote, "During these meetings, a knot of men and women writhed in front of a makeshift mourner's bench before the preacher stands, crying for forgiveness and wailing that they might have a change of heart. Between the dramatic sermons with their high screeches and low moans, hymns added to the building excitement. The congregational parishes of New England still sang in the old style where someone sang out the words of a line in a ponderous, slow rhythm, and the congregation repeated it back. The Methodist camp meetings introduced a lively call and response style that included a chorus everyone could quickly learn and repeat in unison. These were often the same hymns written by Isaac Watts that Lucy Mack recalls her sister singing, and she apparently knew them well. Preachers encouraged participants at the meeting to pray for answers and promise they would come directly from God. Their hymns reinforced this. The noise and movements at these meetings was a show that attracted many onlookers, and the commotion could be heard up the hollows to the tops of the mountains. But the preachers also encouraged individuals to go to a grove of trees on their own and pray, promising God would answer them. Religious seekers became accustomed to retire into the woods to pray, and those groves filled with the prayer people everywhere." End quote.
Sounds like a great recipe for a young, unlearned farm boy to meet his maker with a nice, like, 70s-style wig on.
Or if it's 2000, the 2000s, Joseph Smith has mascara on in all the movies. Can we stop doing that, Mormons? Stop putting blush and makeup on Joseph Smith.
He's beautiful enough in his spirit. He doesn't need makeup. Seriously, though, I wondered enough why Lucy Mack Smith was... Like, I've always wondered why Lucy was so encouraging of her children's religious interests, because if I had told my parents that an angel led me to start a new religion, I'm pretty sure my parents would be pumping the brakes, maybe making me throw all my Smashing Pumpkin CDs in the trash.
Even Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
You know what it says when you play it backwards, right, Brian? It says start your own church.
Absolutely.
But Lucy Mack, like, she was super into it. She was here for it. And it makes sense now when you consider she was absolutely steeped in a religious tradition that allowed for mystical experiences in the woods. Not just allowed for, but encouraged.
And this is where it gets fun. The Universalists that would have come from the Smith side of things were often targeted at those camp meetings, because Universalists taught that God the Father and Jesus were two separate individuals, and the Holy Ghost came in the influence of the Scriptures. They also didn't think Jesus was quite as divine as everyone else. Joseph Sr. and Lucy didn't think the Universalists had enough enthusiasm and began hanging out with the Methodist folks. And apparently, when Joseph Sr.'s family found out that he was consorting with these crazy mountain Methodists, they weren't real happy. The conflict forced Joseph Sr. and Lucy to really contemplate what they believe.
"In the midst of this anxiety of mine, I determined to obtain that which I had heard spoken so much of from the pulpit, a change of heart," Lucy later reported about this time in her life. Quote, "To accomplish this, I spent much of my time in reading the Bible and praying." And as if it's something straight out of the Old Testament, Lucy soon becomes ill with, you guessed it, the consumption that had killed her sisters. It was with her own struggle with this illness that she has her own vision, seeing a, quote, "dark and lonely chasm between myself and Christ." During this time, she kept looking for this light or Jesus, something from the veil like her sisters had seen, but she saw nothing. She was probably not paying her tithing.
Probably drinking too much of that ale.
Or V8, I guess. What's wrong with V8? Spicy V8's
now,
great
for soups. Tabasco kind?
Yeah.
That's a different discussion.
All right, fair enough. Though she longed to see Jesus, she instead hears a voice that tells her to, quote, "seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Let your heart be comforted. Ye believe in God, believe also in me."
Where have I heard this story before? It's right on the tip of my tongue. Slippy.
In the meantime.
Slappy sounds right.
In the meantime, Joseph Smith Sr. wasn't quite so converted. Lucy describes going into several groves of trees, praying and begging that his heart would be softened. And fun fact, she liked to pray in a grove of black cherry trees in a nearby cemetery, which I think is super cool and creepy.
But they weren't called blushing maiden cherries, were they?
Black, dark, wicker visions.
Sounds like a Shasta joke to me. One night, after one of these grove prayers, she has a dream. Quote, I thought that I stood in a large and beautiful meadow, which lay a short distance from the house in which we were living, and that everything around me wore an aspect of peculiar pleasantness. The first thing that attracted my special attention in this magnificent meadow was a very pure and clear stream of water which ran through the midst of it. And as I traced this stream, I discovered two trees standing upon its margin, both of which were on the same side of the stream. These trees were very beautiful. They were well proportioned and towered with majestic beauty to a great height. Their branches, which added to their symmetry and glory, commenced near the top and spread themselves in luxurious grandeur around.
Wait, did Lucy Mack record this vision or Valerie Hudson at BYU? I'm confused.
She continues, quote, I gazed upon them with wonder and admiration, and after beholding them a short time, a bright light surrounded one of them, which appeared like a belt of burnished gold, but far more brilliant. Presently, a gentle breeze passed by, and the trees encircled with this golden zone bent gracefully before the wind and waved its beautiful branches in the light air. As the wind increased, this tree assumed the most lively and animated appearance, and seemed to express in its motions the utmost joy and happiness. If it had been an intelligent creature, it could not have conveyed by the power of language the idea of joy and gratitude so perfectly as it did.
She goes on to describe, quite eloquently, the stream and a belt of light. I turned my eyes, she said, upon its fellow which stood near opposite, but it was not surrounded with a belt of light as the former, and it stood erect and affixed as a pillar of marble. No matter how strong the wind blew over it, not a leaf was stirred, not a bough was bent, but obstinate, stiff it stood, scorning alike the zephyr's breath or the power of a mighty storm. End quote. Lucy interpreted this dream as a confirmation that her husband would bend to the mysticism of the Methodists, the theology of the Presbyterians, and not be as stiff and stern as his universalist rational upbringing.
See, the whole time I'm seeing the trees moving around, I thought it was like the Silly Symphonies. Maybe that's where Disney got it.
I'm sure that and Johnny Appleseed.
I would assume so.
I'm pretty sure the apples and Johnny Appleseed are blushing maiden.
I think it says that in the credits if you watch carefully. Eventually, Joseph Sr. would have a Methodist-style vision that confirmed his universalist belief that everyone would be saved. You get a vision. You get a vision. So her hopes for him here are kind of a bust.
Grave robbers' daughters that poison their father.
Now, if you're thinking like I am that Lucy is incredibly well-spoken and a gifted writer, that isn't by accident. Her background runs a bit like a Jane Austen plot. Lucy's mother was a well-to-do schoolteacher or high-society wealthy woman, and her father was a mystic mountain farmer. Solomon Mack, her dad, had been born into a family that had money, but by age 4, the family lost everything and Solomon was farmed out to relatives. He became wounded as a soldier in the American Revolutionary War, and that really prohibited him from true success as a farmer. He did, however, relish the family with stories of his war triumphs. He was really incredibly religiously minded. He even wrote a biography entitled Narrative of the Life of Solomon Mack, and it talks about his feelings and devotion to Christianity.
Not to be confused with the narrative of the life of Allison Mack. That's a different narrative, just slightly different. As Lindsay said, Lydia Gates was from a wealthy family, and she married poor and for love. And somewhere the ghost of Emma is yelling, Lydia, hold up. Have you thought this one through?
If this were a real Jane Austen story, Mrs. Frances Price and all her squalor with cockroaches and lice tells her daughter, just remember, Fanny, I married for love. Wait, that was the movie. How about this one? Oh, Lydia, do anything rather than marry without affection.
The result? Lucy grows up with refinement and the manners of her mother, but also the mystic mountain spirituality of her father.
One of the fun things about Lucy is her connection to folk rites and folk esotericism.
That's right. There are parts of Lucy's recollections that have become kind of heated ground for scholars. One passage in particular involves a quote where Lucy may have been trying to distance herself from the magic practices she engaged in. Here's the quote, you judge. Let not my reader suppose that because I shall pursue another topic for a season, that we stopped our labor and went at trying to win the faculty of Abrac, drawing magic circles or soothsaying to the neglect of all kind of business. We never during our lives suffered one important interest to swallow up every other obligation. But whilst we worked with our hands, we endeavored to remember the service and the welfare of our souls.
I'd be careful at saying that Lucy was trying to distance herself from the practice, because that's a controversial position still.
Yeah, that's true. Here, I'll clarify. There's an argument, like that of Bill Hamblin and other Mormon apologists, that this quote is Lucy's disavowal of magical practice. But Michael Quinn and many others offer a different interpretation. It was Lucy's acknowledgement of the practices, but distinguishing legitimate spiritual gifts from this, you know, folksy magic nonsense that the poor folk did. It's interesting because part of Lucy's memoirs were pointing out that, though they might have been poor, they were still worthy of being Jane Austen superheroes.
Think of it as similar to Joseph Smith Jr.'s delineation between masonry and the temple ceremony, or polygamy and plural marriage.
Yeah, those are the sort of the two boundaries of the argument. Samuel Brown writes in his article, Reconsidering Lucy Mack Smith's Folk Magic Confession, quote, both sides in the often strenuous debate over the Smith family's relationship to folk esotericism have been satisfied with superficial readings of Lucy's statement. Careful attention to text and context suggests that this statement is a dissembling disavowal of the Smiths' acquaintance with folk esotericism that refuses to admit their involvement with folk rites. In this paragraph, Lucy followed the Protestant master narrative of church dominance to segregate folk rites from respectable ecclesial religion. Historians Eamon Duffy and Keith Thomas have demonstrated for early modern England and John Butler for early America that official religion and folk rites can be quite difficult to separate in practice, even as master narratives maintain that they are separable.
I feel like as a Mormon and being born in the 80s, I encountered this a bit. So it's like Ouija boards are bad, but patriarchal blessings are good. Pentacles, those are devilish. Except the ones on the temple iconography.
I was watching this collection of wacky old commercials, and I saw the one for the board game with the Ouija board in it. And I was like, wow, that took me right back to a kid. Like, there was that specific time in the 80s where I was like, those are bad and evil.
The satanic panic. I remember.
Alive.
I was really young when it happened, but there were older kids in the neighborhood that had gotten a Ouija board, and they were all going to go, do the Ouija board in someone's backyard. And I remember telling my mom, I came inside. I was like six. I just had a bad feeling.
So it could have been a story in the friend. You should have submitted it.
Yeah. Well, it's one of many.
So in any case, Lucy was definitely what we in the modern world would call a mystic. And she was somewhat of an herbalist. You get the idea.
But it actually makes sense in the culture of her time because, listen, I brought this up earlier and I'm sorry to do this again, but The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, have you seen it? And I'm specifically talking about the Walt Disney animated version because
big surprise.
All the rest are garbage. Listen, we're Mormons. We like Disney. It's our FLDS friends. Some of them were excommunicated for watching Finding Nemo and other Disney movies. It's our first step into the real world, which is not a real world at all, but we love Disney. And the best Legend of Sleepy Hollow ever made was Walt Disney's version, and you can go watch it on YouTube. But yeah, go watch it, and it's like exactly what we're thinking. What's interesting is in 1820, the same year that Joseph Smith is having his first vision, Washington Irving puts out The Legend of Sleepy Hollow for the first time. And so there's this whole idea of superstition and mysticism, and that's just how things were. Every tree was a ghost, every forest was haunted at night. The area was teeming with ghosts and haunts and magic and unexplained happenings from other realms. Even the most logical scientific New Englanders still held to a lot of magical traditions. And let's be honest, almost all humans are predisposed to some sort of magical thinking. So if you're out there thinking, that's really dumb that they had visions.
The equivalent today is BYU fans thinking that sacrificing a minivan to the ghost of Johnny Harling will break the losing streak to the U. That's the modern equivalent.
Back to Bill Davis's excellent 2016 dissertation, Performing Revelation, Joseph Smith and the Creation of the Book of Mormon. And in it, he writes, quote, the impulse to resist the dogmas and power structures of established religions encouraged 18th and 19th century seekers like Joseph Sr. and Lucy Mack to look outside the boundaries of traditional Christian denominations, and a smorgasbord of esoteric philosophies and practices awaited the curiosity of those who sought alternative systems of belief, such as Hermeticism, mysticism, Swedenborgism, alchemy, astrology, Freemasonry, Kabbalah.
Rosicrucianism. Say that 5 times fast in the mirror. And
as Swedenborg will appear.
Occultism, mesmerism, and related ideas of animal magnetism. Folk magic practices, all followed by spiritualism in subsequent decades. Rather than looking back to contemporary theologians or their immediate antecedents for answers to life's most pressing questions, inquirers after these philosophies reach back to the dawn of mankind to, quote, recover the divine power and perfection possessed by Adam before the fall and indeed before the creation. This impulse was driven by a common religious belief that Adam and Eve, while in the Garden of Eden, possessed a full knowledge of how the natural world and all the operations of the universe existed in perfect harmony, how the pure Adamic language held the Neoplatonic power to accurately name all the creatures and substances according to their pure linguistic forms, and how unadulterated celestial knowledge could be harnessed to endow the righteous seeker with the power to foretell the future, exert control over the forces of nature, to summon a variety of miracles, and to communicate to God either directly or through the ministering angels.
I like how we got a little Adam God in there in the middle.
His whole dissertation is jam-packed full of good stuff.
Well, if you get to quote something from it, then I get to too. It's full of lots of fun stuff. Here's a good one. Quote, for the lay religious seeker, delving into hidden mysteries offered the opportunity to amalgamate new systems of personal belief that could potentially bring the believer closer to God's ancient, undefiled religion, while simultaneously creating a space for liberated expressions of faith and self-determination. As David Hall observes, quote, prophecy and magic were alike in helping people to become empowered. Prophecy, because it overturned the authority of mediating clergy, and magic, because it gave access to the realm of the occult force, close quote. In post-revolutionary America, belief in magic was common, though it was not necessarily a socially acceptable practice, particularly when professed conjurers hired out their services in an apparent attempt to avoid hard labor. Indeed, the Smith family was often the target of such accusations. Common supernatural practices in early America involved divining rods, dowsing rods, seer and scrying stones, also referred to as crystal gazing or glass looking, magical treasure seeking rituals, prophetic dreaming, charms, and folk medicine, among many other practices. Ordinary people, Richard Bushman argues, apparently had no difficulty blending Christianity with magic. Nevertheless, such latitudinarian attitudes did not prevail when the magicians in question were professional and potentially mercenary.
I think it's interesting that we are casting Lucy as a more mystical one in the relationship with her husband, Joseph Sr. Because remember when I talked earlier about Lucy and Joseph Sr.'s disagreements on religion, her going to the, you know, forest pleading for his faith? That was really rooted in their family view. Lucy's family didn't approve of her marriage to Joseph, who they saw as sort of beneath them. But Lucy's cousin, Joseph Lewis, accused Joseph Sr. of being a, quote, practicing necromancer.
So that's like the idea of communing with the dead. And that's interesting because that's something that our friend Christina looked at in various flavors of Mormonism.
Yeah, was it her dissertation about talking? I remember when Christina, she's a non-Mormon Catholic scholar that studies Mormons, and she's like, I talk, you know, I'm writing about Mormons that talk to the dead. And I was like, or talk to ghosts is what she said. And I said, we don't do that. And she was like, what about the veil and spirits? I was like, oh.
Yeah, we do that a lot.
I guess I'm a necromancer then. It sounds so strange. But anyway, it makes sense to me that Lucy Mack has this need to draw the lines of what the practices were acceptable or not, because it wasn't just about what other people thought about her or later on, you know, changing this narrative about Mormonism to clean it up or something. It's what her upbringing thought about it. Since she had disappointed so many by marrying Joseph Sr., she was trying to legitimize these practices.
And Joseph Sr. really didn't help matters by being pretty crappy at business. Not that that would go down in the family or anything, but... So Sr. is born in 1771 in Topsfield, Massachusetts, to Asel Smith and Mary Duty. And he kind of seemed unlucky at pretty much anything he tries. School teacher, shopkeeper, farmer, investor, entrepreneur, brewer. All of these were pretty much a dud in terms of success. Now, it's possible he attained the degree of Master Mason in 1818 in Ontario Lodge No. 23 in Canandaigua. Now, this one, there's a bit of a debate there. Michael Homer, for example, in Joseph Temples, argues against it being him. He says there was like 8 or 10 Joseph Smiths, and it's kind of far away from their house. Probably not him, but could be. We're staying tuned for Method Infinite, the new book on Masonry that will probably touch on that. Now, what is more certain is that Joseph Sr. grew up as a Universalist, like we talked about, and so as a result, he had an apathy to organized religion that really irked Lucy. But in a way, he was also a mystic in the sort of, you know, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, whatever version you prefer, that you would kind of expect.
Bill Davis, again, in this kick-ass dissertation adds, quote, "Within the liminal milieu of popular culture, mainstream faiths, and fringe philosophies, Joseph Sr. and Lucy Mack developed their ideas and fostered their personal magical practices. A visitor to the Smith home in 1830 described how this Joseph Smith Sr., we soon learned from his own lips, was a firm believer in witchcraft and other supernatural things, and had brought up his family in the same belief. Thus, for their children, as well as themselves, this complex entanglement of religious and hermetic ideologies became the Smith family's way of life, constructing a cultural and perceptual lens through which they view and interpret the world," end quote. And isn't it Sr.'s family that comes from the Salem area?
Yes.
In the 1600s?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they were around for the whole idea of crazy Puritan witch stuff.
Maybe they brought a few torches. Who knows? So both parents would go on to raise their kids according to their own worldviews, which comes out very clearly in the life of Joseph Smith Jr.'s story. He's one of 11 children, but he's the one that goes on to have visions, produce the Book of Mormon, and lead a large religious movement. But not, interestingly enough, practice polygamy.
That's a nice little fun fact. Thank you.
Fun fact there, yeah. Not many people know about that. But
that's sort of a new restoration of...
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Maybe he got that from an ancient ancestor.
It's possible. But, so as a result, his parents get the ticket to ride on that train and follow Mormonism until their deaths. Senior was baptized when Junior's church, the Church of Christ, was formally organized on April 6, 1830. When Junior sees Senior coming up out of the waters of baptism, it's said he shouts out, quote, "Oh, my God, I have lived to see my own father baptized into the true Church of Jesus Christ." It really was an emotional moment for him. Then, when the movement settles in Kirtland, Senior is set apart as the presiding patriarch in 1833.
And you know you're an OG Mormon when you have your patriarchal blessing given to you from Joseph Smith Sr. A blessing from that guy puts you squarely at ground level Mormonism. His role of patriarch meant he gave patriarchal blessings to church members and presided in council meetings. And when Junior set him apart, he compared him to the Bible and Adam, who was supposed to be the first patriarch of all, which seems like an idea that Lucy had in her system already with Adam and Eve. "So shall it be with my father. He shall be called a prince over his posterity, holding the keys of the patriarchal priesthood over the kingdom of God on earth, even the church of the Latter-day Saints," end quote.
Back to the idea of him kind of sucking at things he did. We could probably do a whole episode on his failed ginseng investment. I mean, it really cast a pall over the rest of their financial life. But it's likely, you know, he really just could never get his crap together. And as a result, he never makes it much higher in the church than putting his hands on people's heads and telling them stuff. He was made an assistant counselor to Junior in the first presidency in 1837. So that's something, but it really never translated into much of anything in practice.
And the Smith family was historically really tight. They supported each other. But I think Lucy always felt like Senior never quite lived up to her choice to marry him. She was always a little embarrassed. But any religious ambition she wished on her husband was absolutely fulfilled in other males in the family. Or should I say, other Josephs in the family.
William? Doesn't get it?
Not quite. He was really good at debate school, though.
And punching folks. You know, I don't know why she wasn't into it. On his deathbed, Senior blessed Lucy, quote, "Mother, do you not know that you are the mother of as great a family as ever lived upon the earth? They are raised up to do the Lord's work."
I feel like that's a really bold claim. Greatest family to ever live on the earth? Ever? I feel like the greatest Mormon family ever were the Osmonds. And second place, obviously, the Bundys, if you're in Idaho.
And third place, Ty, LeBarons, and Lafferty's, I think is how the votes were tallied.
This has gone as dark as Lucy's first vision.
Certainly not as good as the beer recipe, that's for sure. Well, at least by that point, Senior seems to have that change of heart she was always hoping for. So one point there.
As for Lucy, she saw Mormonism as not just the endeavor of one son, because as Jan Shipps points to, Lucy often referred to the royal we and our when she was talking about founding efforts of Mormonism. It was their church. It was a family thing.
Yeah, she gets some pride out of Mormonism, but doesn't really bring her a lot of happiness in the end. When Junior and Hiram are killed in Carthage, she reportedly said, quote, my God, why hast thou forsaken this family? And that's before Samuel dies. So, I mean, that was not a great
moment. Or Samuel was poisoned by Hosea Stout.
That filthy murderer. And Lucy also wrote, quote, I was left desolate in my distress. I had reared 6 sons to manhood, and of them all, one only remained, and he sucks. Okay, she didn't really say that part, but... And he too far distant to speak one consoling word to me in this trying hour. Yeah, the one son that's left is William. And like we've talked about, he was prone to going off the rails.
Lucy would die in 1856 and never traveled west with the Latter-day Saints. She opted to stay with her surviving kids and beloved daughter-in-law, Emma Smith. Her opinions on the Brighamite Church are still somewhat of a mystery and a bit of a controversy, too. Did Brigham edit her accounts of Joseph Smith? Why, yes, he did. Did Martha Corey, her biographer, edit Lucy Mack's biography? Yes, she did. Corey apparently edited for clarification, and Brigham Young's edits were the results of, as he puts it, quote, Mother Smith was 70 years old and very forgetful. And a lot of people say this is Brigham Young trying to change the Smith narrative, and it's possible, especially when he claims that Mother Smith was so old and didn't remember the right way.
It's kind of funny to hear Brigham telling people they don't remember Mormon history accurately.
Here's where I will give the anti-polygamy deniers a bone. Like, Brigham Young absolutely did change the narrative, for sure. But he didn't invent polygamy. Anyway, a lot of folks, especially Brighamites at the time, attributed Lucy Mack's early accounts of Joseph Smith as the result of trauma. They suggested that her mind, quote, had suffered many severe shocks, and that she could therefore scarcely recollect anything correctly that had transpired. And is this just the result of epic gaslighting and sexism? Or was she some withered old decrepit? You decide, especially considering that many that encountered Lucy Mack after Brigham Young headed west thought her to be incredibly intelligent, astute, and sharp as a tack. Like artist Frederick Piercy said after meeting her right before her death, he said she, quote, retained her faculties to a remarkable degree. The reasons for the edits of her history and biographies and autobiographies differ, but needless to say, scholars are still debating Lucy Mack's lasting feelings on Brigham Young, the Brighamite faction in general, and the reorganized church.
It's likely that Lucy's support for William as contender for church leader and her belief that Mormonism was a Smith family brand probably threatened Brigham. In any case, she does stay back, stay true to the memory of her sons and Mormonism. We could talk about Lucy for hours, especially considering we spent hours going through Richard Lloyd Anderson's papers on her. That was a lot of fun. But this introduction into who Joseph Smith Jr.'s parents were hopefully helps place them into a more rich context. Looking at tonight's forecast, we see a Books of Mormon report front moving in from the west. All right, first up, geez, I don't know, the book we mentioned about 87 times during this episode, Joseph and Lucy Smith's Tunbridge Farm, an Archaeology and Landscape Study, written by Mark Staker and Don Enders, and published by our friends at John Whitmer Books. Mark Staker, you might remember, is also the author of Hearken, O Ye People, a fantastic book about the Ohio period. And Don has been working on the Smith family for approximately 12 consecutive decades. He has been in the game for a long time. It's a concise book. It's a fascinating account of what these digs around their farm in Vermont can tell us. Now, for Lucy's history, we've talked about this before. There are various editions of it. For you listeners, you have fancy continental palettes. You've really got to get Levina Fielding Anderson's Lucy's book. Fascinating. It's a two-column presentation. You have the rough draft, and then you have the first published account. And then in footnotes, she talks about the differences. But then also, there are some excellent essays. You get on one, some on Lucy herself, and then also detailed accounts of the very complicated history of this history. Fantastic book. Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. Brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young.
as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.